Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in studio is Ms. Tandiswa Mzwai, a multi-award-winning South African musician. She began her career in 1998 with Bongo Muffin, one of the pioneering bands of Kwaito. After six award-winning albums with Bongo Muffin, she ventured into a solo career. Zabalaza, her debut project, reached double platinum status and won numerous awards, including a CORE Award for Best African Female Artist and four South African Music Awards. It was nominated for the BBC Radio 3 Planet Awards. Her critically acclaimed second album, Ibokwe, reached gold status in the first few weeks of its release, and her recent live DVD, Dance of the Forgotten Free, won South African Music Awards for Best African Artist and Best Live DVD in 2011. The Guardian recently called her South Africa's finest female contemporary singer. On the academic side, Tandiswa went on to attend Wits University, where she studied English literature and international relations. Tandiswa Mzwai is one of the most influential musicians on the South African music scene today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for that introduction.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Starting right at the very beginning, you were born in 1976, the year of the Soweto uprising. You grew up in Soweto, Johannesburg, mm-hmm. and amidst the heavy apartheid township violence of the 1980s, both of your parents were journalists and anti-apartheid political activists. And in your biography, you've stated that your recollection of the home you grew up in is one that is filled with books, articles, and thick with political discussions. Mm-hmm. And it was an environment which nurtured your perspective as an artist.
Yes.
Can you please share with us some of those moments from those years in your life, growing up as a child, and actually witnessing in the most profound way the birth of the South African nation?
Well, you know, I have a kind of two-pronged experience of this, is that, you know, I remember growing up in apartheid South Africa, and I'm also still young in the new South Africa, I assume. I think almost 40 is still young. So growing up as a child, I guess I didn't quite understand that I lived a life of the oppressed, because, you know, it's human nature forces you to survive. And so in my environment, it seemed that we were surviving and that we were surviving well. But the thing that introduced me to it, to politics and to this difference of lives, was one, the police presence in Soweto. And the second thing was that my parents had white friends, obviously. apartheid couldn't separate people completely. So my parents had some white friends, and I would sometimes spend time at some of the white people's homes. And it became clear to me how stark the difference was in lifestyles. And so growing up with my parents, this was constantly being discussed, you know. And my parents were, I would say, left. Growing up, we were PAC in the family, and so the discourse was always very much about black consciousness, very much about the progress of black people. I grew up, you know, late nights, my parents would have meetings with people like the now late Khoisan X and other great leaders within the PAC movement. I think one of the things that stands out to me is how we used to greet each other, because when they walked into the house, you would always raise your right palm, and they would greet me as daughter of the soil, and I would greet them as sons of the soil.
Is that part of the PAC?
Yeah, that was kind of how we greeted each other, was to call ourselves children of the soil. And this stuck with me, you know. It was one of those things that reminded me. It was a very, how can I say, it was a very...
It seems very textured.
Yeah, it was
rich.
It was something that just kind of reminded me of who I am at a time when my identity was one of inferiority. It was a racist identity. So growing up at home, these were the things that influenced me. And my parents used to read a lot of books. I remember my mother used to say, every time I said to her, I'm bored. And she'd point to this little room that we had in the house full of books. And she'd say, go and hang out with Achebe, go and hang out with Fanon, go and hang out with Biko, you know. And I was too young to really know or understand what I was reading in Fanon's books. But as I grew and as I went to university, these became the most important books I'd ever read and the most important books I'd been exposed to.
I think that that's incredibly interesting in talking about the life writings, the works of people like Steve Biko, Frantz Fanon, Chinua Achebe, and Kwame Nkrumah,
yes,
which led you years later to become widely recognized as a voice of South Africa's conscious youth. And you said, and I quote, "My work gave me an opportunity to share my thoughts and have a meaningful conversation with my generation about blackness, Africanness, and about some of the social ills that plague us, as
yes,
well as freedom and joy." Can you please share with us some of your thoughts on those matters?
I think one of the main things that stands out as a South African was the addition of the word new to being a South African. You know, it was, you are now a new South African. And I grappled a lot with this. I think at first I was taken up by the euphoria of this newfound freedom and this new South Africa we were building. But I didn't quite buy into the idea that I was a new South African. And I didn't buy into the idea that others were new. And so I've always felt that we as South Africans have had to be very real about the fact that it is not a new South Africa, but it is a South Africa in progress, that this is a work in progress, and that we didn't become new by the magic waving of Madiba's wand, this Madiba magic. I think it sustained us for a little bit, but after that we needed to get to grips with the fact that racism is a very real part of South African life. Separation is a big part of South African life, not only geographically but economically, and that in order for us to be truly new, we have to interrogate these things. We have to interrogate what freedom really means, what forgiveness means. That's also one of the things that fascinates me now, is about this idea of forgiveness, you know, that a great part of this country had to do this act of forgiveness. And I wonder what forgiveness does if the other party didn't ask for it. Does it actually work if no one asked for it? If you just forgive, is there a reciprocal, is there a response to that forgiveness? So I'm trying to interrogate the response to forgiveness in South Africa.
And I think that that's an interesting point that you raise, from a point of view that forgiveness was asked by an older generation, if we can put it in that context. A couple of years ago, I participated in a Reconciliation Day TV special broadcast when they did the unveiling of the Nelson Mandela statue at the Union Buildings. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, there were some shocking statistics that were revealed in that particular show, that the young generation is not fully aware, and in some instances almost seem to be on the verge of denial about the seriousness of apartheid and the consequences.
Yeah.
Now, your work constantly puts you in touch with this younger generation.
Yes.
What's your intake on it?
Well, I think what you say is true. But I also think the reason that it's true is because they didn't live that experience. It's not a lived experience. It's one that is being... it's like an oral history, you know. Like, I have a child who's 15 who thinks that I'm a complete racist because of some of the things that I say. But I think it's because I'm a South African who's almost 40 that race is a very much, or racial interrogation and racial interaction is very much at the forefront of my engagement with South African society. I'm always aware. And these are some of the things that I have to agree with myself. I mean, I had to say to myself that I have to be a racist in recovery. And that, I think, was the first real thing I ever did as a true new South African, was to accept that racism is a part of our lives, and that in order for us to move forward, we have to accept that we are in recovery for all of these things, from racist assault, from racist thinking, from all of these things that racism has created around us. So my child grew up in, you know, she grew up in the suburbs of South Africa. She's had a very cushy life, a life that's not necessarily that much different from the white kids that she goes to school with. Whereas for me, it was a very, very stark difference. As from a black kid to a white kid, this difference was stark. My daughter's life is not that different from any other middle class person, regardless of their race. But I also do know that as a black person living in the world as it is today, you will always face racism. If you don't face it, you'll face it in South Africa, you'll face it in America, you'll face it. I mean, I travel all over the world, and all over the world I'm confronted by racism. And I wonder always why it is that black people are the brunt of this. Because everywhere I go, I experience it. Whether I'm in Asia, whether I'm in Europe, I experience this sense of otherness, this sense of even a kind of hate. A kind of content. So I have to kind of, I feel that as a parent I have to give my child the tools to be able to survive that, but also to remind her that her life shouldn't be about survival, that her life should be about joy and about expression and about being free, you know. But she does have to have the tools to survive as a black person in this world.
She leads unarguably a totally, she lives in a different period, she yes. lives in a different world to what you grew up in, mm-hmm. in the same age frame. But in her growing up, do you feel compelled to remind her about the events that you've experienced so that she
Absolutely.
Doesn't forget?
Absolutely.
And I think one of the areas that I also feel is important, that we need to be teaching the youth today about the likes of Steve Biko.
Absolutely. What I find quite shocking to me right now is that my child is still learning about Napoleon Bonaparte, and she'll tell you the history of Napoleon, but she will not tell you about Neander, who's from here, Zimbabwe. She can't give you a full history of... If you said to her, give me the name of one African historian, she won't know. One African mathematician, she won't know. One African scientist. So I believe that, you know, education should be, like, radically changed in South Africa in order to reflect a positive... It's more than that. It's in order to give the future children something more than a history of oppression, something more than a history of subjugation, but give them the rest of our history, a history of...
They need to value their heritage.
The history of our empires, the history of our great leaders, the history of our great successes, you know. Africa has great successes, but none of these are taught in schools as part of the syllabus. It's almost as if the parents have to do that for themselves. But what my child learns right now at school, she learns about white power. That's what my child learns about. She learns about how white people have succeeded in the world and learns very little about how black people have succeeded in the world.
So focusing on traditional Western civilizations, going through with the world wars.
Absolutely.
And the establishment of those old empires.
Yeah.
And you were so right. There has been a lack of focus on, as you said in your quote, Africanness.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Zonke Dikana, a South African Afro-soul musician, songwriter and producer. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
Today we're talking to Thandiswa Mzwai, a multi-award-winning South African musician. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Now, you have said that music gave you an opportunity to feed your revolutionary self, and I found that very inspiring. Your compositions today have included traditional Xhosa rhythms, reggae, kwaito, funk, and jazz. And through this, you've managed to straddle urban and the rural, effortlessly melding the traditional with the modern. I think that's very deep. Can you take us a bit further and share some of your thoughts on this?
I'm not quite sure how I did it, but I think it's mostly about what the artist obsesses about. That's what feeds the work. And my obsession from early on in my career had always been my mother. I lost my mother when I was 16, and she was a very staunch Africanist, you know. And so a lot of my work has been about making my mother proud, and also has been about remembering the things that my mother has taught me. So it's been a lot about memory. And so in interrogating memory and interrogating the importance of memory, I kind of inadvertently brought memory into a contemporary space. And for me, memory involved identity. That's what my memory was obsessing with, was identity and language and culture. And so these were the things that I brought into my music. But I also wanted, you know, there were certain things that at the time, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, but at the time, you were hard-pressed to find, within the local music scene, South African music scene, you were hard-pressed to find someone that represented a traditional sensibility, you know. Everybody was extremely urban. And
would you say that goes probably towards the commercialization of music? Because when you're going into the industry, there is always a commercial aspect.
Yeah, I mean, you're told that you have to sell this music. But it's also this idea that you can't sell tradition, and you can't sell, you know, you have to sell what's in.
Yes.
And what's in is always defined by people outside of your own realm. So what was in at the time and still is in is very much American culture. And so I became obsessed with looking for voices that were African to influence me. Growing up, you know, in high school, I was listening to Whitney Houston and Regina Bell and all these kinds of people. But when I got into the music industry and I started being questioned about what was my particular identity and what was my particular image, I had to create something that I felt resonated with me and was honest and authentic to me. And so I looked at people such as Miriam Makeba and Busim Hlongo and Fela Kuti, and these became voices that interested me, not only in what they spoke, but in also how they treated their voices, you know. These were truly African voices. They were not trying to polish themselves up. They sounded like women from my village, or sounded like men from my village. And so I began to want to emulate these things, you know. So I think that's the thing that has separated me, I guess. At the time, it separated me because no one remembered Miriam Makeba in the space that I inhabited, you know. A lot of young people were obsessed with American culture, like I said. And so for us as Bongo Muffin to come out and our first hit was a remake of a Miriam Makeba track, I think that was the thing that brought people's attention to us. Every African singer who comes after Miriam Makeba cites her as one of the great influences. And it's not just South African singers. It's singers from Mali, from West Africa, from East Africa. She was a great influence for all the vocalists on this continent. And I'm just one of them.
And I think that that's been one of the strengths. When people have their authenticity, their identity, that's part of the elements for success.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that one of the most important words I learned from my father, which is one of the first big words I learned, was the word integrity. And I think it's stuck with me because I always want to inject that into my work, because I believe that if your work is honest, then it resonates. So, which is why it's so hard to create this work, because you have to dig so deep into your own.
It's very personal.
It's very, very personal.
Now, you have performed all over the world in venues like the FIFA 2010 World Cup opening ceremony, the Apollo Theatre, Radio City Hall, Womix, the Cannes Film Festival, the Barbican, Africa Brazil Festival, FESPACO Film Festival, the BBC World Music Awards.
I don't think you can name them all.
Which goes to testimony on your 20 years of success in this industry and several Mandela 4664 concerts. You've also shared the stage with legends like Salifa Keita, Skunk Anansie, Cesaria Evora, Stevie Wonder, Angelique Kidjo, and many others. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us some of the milestones that you still want to accomplish in your career and what we can expect from you in the near future?
I'm a very simple person in that I take things one step at a time. I'm not one of those people that has a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. So the thing that I want to achieve most right now is to create a new album. Yeah, I just don't see how life can continue if I don't create a new album.
And when we were talking offline, you'd mentioned that the last new album that you had was
seven years ago. And so there's a lot to speak about, but there's also the burden of remaining relevant, of remaining contemporary. It's hard trying to create work after such a long time.
Definitely. Can you take us through the process briefly? Typical process.
I mean, the process changes every time, because every time I'm working with different people. I mean, on the Zabalaza album, the process was very, very simple, because I had a producer who created beats for me, and all I had to do was come with the words and the melodies, and that was easy. On Ibokwe, it took me 2 years to write the album, because I was creating the everything from scratch myself. And so I didn't have anyone creating the beats for me. I had to do everything from scratch. But I think the easiest way, I would say, for me in terms of songwriting is what I'm always doing is writing. I always have a little notebook that I write in thoughts. So I write thoughts all the time. And then when it comes time to songwrite, I look through these books and I pick words and I pick statements and things that I think are powerful and that will resonate, and I try to put melodies to them. And other times I have a melody and I don't have words, but I have a melody. So when that happens, I usually get, like a band of percussionists or something to lay down a rhythm track, and then I can put the words down and just keep listening to them until something else comes up. But it's a very, very slow, grueling process, because I rely very much on inspiration. And I know that a lot of writers will say, don't wait for inspiration, do it. But I rely very much on inspiration, so I wait. And that's why it takes so long.
Well, I think everybody's got their own method.
Mm-hmm.
And what works for you
is what works for you,
exactly. Yeah. And finding the triggers of inspiration. It sounds like you do everything yourself.
I have done that in the past, but now I'm thinking of involving a lot more people. You know, it's harder to work alone. I think at the place that I am now, I'm much more interested in collaboration, in doing things differently. You know, the problem about being Tandiswa Mazwai right now in the music industry is that people view me as the sole traditional voice. You know, even though what I do is not really traditional music, but it is very much based on that. And this is a burden for me, because even when I want to experiment and try new things, people say, oh, no. You're departing from what we expect from you.
Those fans have their own expectations
they have their own expectations of what I'll be doing. And I am an artist, and change is paramount. I always say that one of the finest attributes an artist can have is, you know, a true commitment to creativity. And creativity means you're doing something new. You're not regurgitating, you're not doing it again. You're doing something completely new. And so I always sit and think, oh, I hope they don't think this is going far out. But, you know, I thought that about Ibokwe, and they enjoyed that. So I don't know.
It's also opening up new sounds to new audiences.
Absolutely. And I feel, it kind of feels like, as a South African, my space, and I'm sure that a lot of South Africans feel this way, which is kind of boxed in, you know, like you can't really get out, you can't scream, you can't, but there's so much bottled in when you're a South African. And so as an artist, I feel like, you know, I need to get out of this box. It's hard to explain, but it's very much about getting out of myself, getting out of, you know, we have this history, it binds us, it locks us down. We have these issues, they bind us, they keep us frustrated, they keep us in a rage. And as an artist, I want to get out of that, you know, and in order to do that, I use my work. And the easiest way to do that in my work is to keep breaking the rules of what you think I'm supposed to be.
Yes, it's being challenged
by
your limitations,
absolutely,
going beyond them. And often that comes through from collaborations and having exposure to new ideas.
To new ideas, absolutely.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Lira, South African Afro-Soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Tandiswa Mzwai, a multi-award-winning South African musician. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Whilst we're on the topic of music and the creative process, music has always been a huge inspiration to people, but occasionally it's been exploited to influence political and social agendas around the world. How do you see the role of musicians in that regard?
Well, you know, to each his own, first of all, but I'm the kind of musician that does not engage like that. I don't use my work to push some kind of political agenda. I think what's much more important to me than party politics is the people. And I always feel that, you know, we can always rely on politicians to disappoint us. And so it's not my place as an artist to go and tell people to vote for so-and-so, because that when that person disappoints, you know, I sold this fake dream to people. So I don't do that. What I do is I listen to people around me, I listen to their issues, and I try to write work that will question the leadership, that will push the leadership to perhaps try other ways. I like to play on the side of the voice of the people than the voice of the system, or the voice there's a word for it when you give people, what's the word? It is propaganda. The voice of propaganda, because this is what politicians do, right, is they sell propaganda. They tell you, oh, we'll do this, we'll do that, and we the people, and together we can. And in the end, what we find is that the people are on one side, and that the powers that be are on the other. And so I'm with the people. It might not make me rich, but it'll keep me honest.
That's very valuable. Now, we were talking briefly about leadership. This program is all about gender equality, which is increasingly a global focus. And as such, building female leadership capacity is important both for the future of women and also to South Africa as a country. As a role model to so many South Africans, how do you see female leadership, whether it's in the political space, parliament, schools, business, music, or any other field? And one of the points that I cite frequently, for instance, is the South African Women in Business Association released a survey in 2012. It was a census that they did where they identified that only 21.4% of executive management on JSE-listed companies were women. Mm-hmm. And when you looked at the level of CEOs, there were only 3.6% that were women. Mm. And I consider that given our population, we've got 52% are women. We are the majority. Mm-hmm. But yet, in leadership positions, there just doesn't seem to be enough of a female voice.
This is true, and it isn't. I think that women play a very important role in society. But obviously are closed out of the formal spaces that would qualify this role that women play, and this is systemic of patriarchy and of all the things that are connected with that patriarchy. But you know, if I look at the music industry, is full of women, but usually the women are in roles of, you know, they're backup singers or they are dancers, you know. And so one of the things that I did was I started playing with an all-female band. One, because the men that I played with thought it would be impossible to play with an all-female band and that my music would sound terrible and these women would never be able to play my music. And I wanted to prove them wrong. But I also thought that it would be interesting for other young women who see these women on stage. There's something empowering about a stage full of women.
And doing it all yourself.
And so, you know, everywhere we go now, I see people's, you know, the lights go on in young women's eyes. Last week we had a gig, and there were lots of young people there who were just smitten with the band, and they just couldn't believe there's a woman on bass, there's a woman on drums, there's a woman on guitar, there's a woman everywhere, you know. So, you know, for myself as a woman, I've never taken my place and felt that it was a place that needed to be fought for. I always knew of my place, you know. And so I would think that what needs to be taught to young women is to inhabit their spaces. I find that men do that quite eloquently, you know. Like when a man sits on a chair, he sits and he, you know, he owns the entire chair, and he opens his legs, and he owns the chair.
Very assertive.
Very assertive. But a woman might sit there and be a little bit. I almost feel that women want to hide in spaces. They don't want to own their spaces, you know. So what I try to tell my daughter is that it doesn't matter that she's a girl or a boy or she's whatever she is, she inhabits a space that no one else can. Where you stand, this is your space. You must stand in that space with pride and with force. Obviously, it's true that women are outside of a lot. But the conversations I have and the kind of women that I surround myself with are very, very powerful women. And the conversations we have are very powerful conversations. I mean, I read a Nina Simone autobiography, and she was speaking about a girlfriend of hers, and she said, oh, we spoke about revolution and such girl talk, you know, like this is true girl talk. And it reminds me of Alison Birchdale. She's a feminist writer, cartoonist, and she came up with this thing called the Birchdale test, which looks at film and sees whether or not when two women are in a frame in a movie, what do they discuss? And this is what makes it a feminist movie or not. It's feminist if two women in that movie talk about everything besides men, fashion, clothes, lipstick, whatever. But if they discuss something else, then this is a feminist movie. And you find that there's very few movies where just two women are on frame talking about something other than men or other than beauty or fashion. And
that's a challenge with the media, because the media often stereotypes people.
Exactly.
And that is what is regurgitated into the public domain.
Exactly. And
so
I mean,
more people see it, and it
I'm in an industry where women are extremely sexualized, for instance. And so as much as, you know, of course, women have a sexuality and they have a right to express that sexuality, it's a problem if it is being presented as our one identity. So I just think, you know, I've always treated myself as a whole person, and that being a woman was incidental. But it's also a very powerful part of who I am.
And in your experience and your opinion, what is it that you think we need to build on the most to benefit women in the future?
I would think it is about visibility. The more empowered women we see, the more empowering it is. You know, it's kind of the same thing with, the gay community. If people don't come out, then it stays a taboo. It stays like a hidden, it's a hidden community of people. But the more and more people come out, this dispels some of the myths. So I feel that women need to come out of their shells and express themselves in bold ways, because this is how other women are inspired, and this is how we change how the world views us.
One of the points we touched on briefly was about patriarchy, mm-hmm. as being a negative factor in terms of women's development and in pursuit of equality. Gender equality sometimes touches on very sensitive points, whether it is culture, religion, tradition.
Absolutely.
Do you think it would be possible to overcome these points for the sake of women's development?
To overcome the issues around religion and culture?
Culture, religion, tradition.
Do I think it's possible? I think it's a mammoth task, because these are old ideas about, you know, how the world is supposed to be, the balance. I don't think you can win when you bring religion and culture into it. The only way you win is when you bring individuals into it, when you say, look at me as an individual, I'm not less than you as an individual. But if you start bringing culture into it, people are going to say, no, a woman must know her place, a woman cooks, a woman wears a duk, a woman takes care of the babies while the man goes to work. But none of these things work in today's modern society. And if you bring in religion, it's even worse, because it is the word of God, you know, and people don't like to bend that too much, although they do, you know, to support things such as racism and to support things such as sexism. So that's why I think that it's much more of a woman's fight, because it is when women stand up for themselves and say that I am not less than you. It's an individual thing. It's, you know, if you fight for yourself, then the world will respond. There was a video that went viral the other day of a girl who was sitting on a plane in India, and an older man was sitting next to her, and he touched her. And the first time he touched her, she kind of ignored it and thought, this is weird. And then he did it again. And so she stood up and made a lot of noise. This is on an airplane. Made a lot of noise, pulled out her phone and filmed him. And she told him, you know, she said, you know, you think that because I'm a woman that I must stay with the shame. I'm going to film you and shame you because I refuse to keep this shame, you know. And I think that that girl, having stood up for herself, she flipped it on him. And so she did not keep the shame that comes with being touched without your permission. And this man is completely shamed. The video is viral. His family is shamed. And so I think it really is about teaching our daughters to speak up, teaching our daughters to know that if it doesn't feel right, then you can make a noise about it. A lot of women keep things in, and they say nothing about the things that make them sad. And so, I think it's every woman has to fight this in her own space. Of course, we band together to fight for other women, but it is really important for us in moving forward to teach our daughters to speak up.
Now, as an individual and a strong individual with 20 years of success under your belt, a lot of the women that I've interviewed who've been guests on the show have spoken about factors that they determine attribute to this success as being hard work, perseverance. In your opinion, from your perspective, what do you consider to be the key drivers to your success?
I'm very passionate about my work, and I put my entire being into it. And I think that has been the reason for my success, is that it resonated with people. But I guess on a much more tangible note, I would say, you know, traveling all over the world with my music, what has kept me playing at festivals around the world is that I make music that no one else can. That I didn't copy something from another part of the world, that my work is South African, and this is what keeps me going. There's always this burden for black artists to create black work, work that has to do with blackness. And I don't think that any artist has to live with that burden. Of course, you know, you can create any work that you want to create. But for me, this is what has worked, is what has kept me here has been my perspective as an artist, which is an African perspective. That's the thing that has kept me working.
Thank you for highlighting those points as key factors with regards to your success. We're coming to the end of the show. Can you please share with us a few words of inspiration that you'd like to pass on to young girls in the continent who are listening to the show?
I think I'll keep it simple and say that you have a right to be. You're a girl and you have a right to be. You don't have to hide. You don't have to be in the background. You can be in the front. You can be bold. You can be loud. You can speak your mind. You can do as you please. You can be whoever you want to be. You can be great. There's nothing standing in your way except your own perception of yourself, because what other people think of you doesn't matter. It's really what you think of yourself. And if you don't listen to them telling you that you are less than them, then you have a greater chance of being even greater.
Thank you very much for sharing those points of inspiration and for underscoring factors of identity, individuality, uniqueness as being part of the package which has made you who you are and the success that you are today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Dandiswa Mzwai. Tune into the show next week when we talk to Professor Beatrice Lekay, the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Information, Knowledge and Infrastructure Management at the University of Witwatersrand, South Africa, and Professor of Electrical and Electronic Engineering.